It's 7:30 on this West Virginia morning. I'm Ashton Mara. The 2013 Professor of the Year says she's proud of the honor, but isn't letting the new title stop her from growing as a teacher.
The minute I stop trying to be a better teacher is the minute I should stop walking into the classroom. And so I'm getting better, but I want to keep getting better.
Her story coming up on West Virginia Morning. The controversy over the balance of power set up by our state's constitution was forced into the spotlight this month when Governor Tomlin chose to veto the Pain-Capable Unborn Child Protection Act, a bill that made abortions in West Virginia illegal after 20 weeks. There's no question whether or not the governor can veto the bill. The question lawmakers want answered is, now that it's done, what power did they have to reverse the decision? We're looking to the Constitution, two attorney general opinions, and a 100-plus-year-old state Supreme Court decision for answers. In his veto message to Secretary of State Natalie Tennant, Tomlin wrote, quote, "I hereby disapprove and return enrolled House Bill 4588. I am advised the bill is unconstitutional under controlling precedent of the Supreme Court of the United States." End quote. The federal Supreme Court has already overturned an Arizona bill containing a very similar post-20-week ban, as well as written other decisions disapproving the practice of limiting a woman's ability to get an abortion before what's considered the stage of viability, or 24 weeks. With that, the West Virginia bill was shot down, even after passing both chambers by an overwhelming majority. The House supported the measure on a vote of 83-15, and in the Senate, 29-5. Since the disapproval, Democrats and Republicans alike have expressed concern over the decision, going as far as calling for a special session to override the veto. But that's where the constitutional question has evolved. Under our current system, can the legislature override a veto after the regular session has adjourned? House Minority Leader Tim Armstead says he thinks the answer is obvious.
I believe the Constitution, while it's silent and it could be more clear on that issue, I believe the Constitution allows us to go back into session and override a veto.
But other members of the House are not so sure. House attorneys are currently researching their options, as confirmed by General Counsel for the Chamber Joe Altizer, but declined to release any specifics on what exactly they're looking into or who has ordered the research. A Supreme Court decision from 1909, however, indicates that the minority leader's assumption may be correct. In May versus Topping, Maude May's husband, Attorney General Clark May, passed away after his annual salary was approved by the legislature, but before the governor vetoed it. May was asking the court, as the executor of her husband's estate, to order then House Clerk C.L. Topping to pay her that $2,000-some salary as the legislature had approved. The court ultimately ruled in May's favor, saying while the governor did have 5 days to enroll his objections to the appropriation, he did so after the legislature had adjourned, preventing him from returning the bill to its originating chamber for reconsideration and a possible override. In a larger sense, the court decision says the ultimate veto power is reserved for the people who are represented by their legislators. The court summed up any future doubt in who may hold the ultimate power by saying, quote, "Thus we see that the legislative, not the executive will, has been made supreme. Is it not the legislative will in whose favor such doubt should be resolved?" End quote. The court was saying, should there be doubt in who has the final say over a proposed law, the doubt should be resolved by assuming the legislature has the ultimate power. The decision, however, was written before language was added in the 1970s. The current Constitution gives the governor 15 days after adjournment to register his veto with the Secretary of State's office instead of the 5 days allotted when the 1909 ruling was written. Still, the decision seems to support Armstead's position that the legislature has the ultimate say and not the stance of the governor's office that the vetoed bill is dead and cannot be reconsidered. But Armstead says it comes back to decades of the legislature deferring its power to the office of governor.
I think it's important from a legislative standpoint that we do our job and we don't cede any of that role to the courts or to the governor. I think it's important that the governor do his job and not cede those powers to the legislature or the courts, not because it's a power issue or anything. It's just because it's how it works. And I think what I think we're seeing to some degree is, have been seeing over the years, is it's more of a political deference.
Armstead and other House Republicans have called on Attorney General Patrick Morrissey for an official, modern opinion on the issue. In a letter dated April 9th addressed to legislative leaders, Morrissey concluded the legislature could override a veto in a legislatively initiated special session. That means a session called after 3/5 of the members of each chamber petition the governor. He goes on to say there was no clear statement in the Constitution that restricts the override authority, which the Supreme Court in a 1980 decision said must be present. Morrissey ends the letter, however, by saying, quote, "We have found no court case deciding the authority of a legislature-initiated special session to override such a veto, nor have we located any examples of such a special session attempting to override such a veto," end quote. He writes, "Lawmakers should caution testing such power when it takes only a simple majority to override the governor's veto." Morrissey suggests instead, lawmakers could call themselves into session, pass another bill essentially with the same language, recess to await the inevitable second veto, and override it with the same simple majority vote it took to pass the bill. Governor Tomlin is already calling for a special session during May interims to address overtime issues with a recently approved bill to increase the state minimum wage. But, as per his constitutional powers, since he is calling the special session, he also retains the right to set the agenda. However, as Morrissey states, should the legislature call themselves back into session with a petition of 3/5 of the members of each chamber, they reserve the right to set the agenda. And his stance is backed by an opinion written in 1954 by then Attorney General John Fox. In that opinion, Fox writes, "When the legislature petitions themselves into session, they should be considered to be in a plenary or open session and can, quote, act on any subject not interdicted by the Constitution itself." However, he maintains, should the governor call that session, lawmakers are bound to the governor's agenda with some flexibility in its interpretation. That means for the May session, legislatures could not take up the abortion bill unless the governor decides to put it in the call, which is unlikely. Instead, if a decision is made to attempt an override or vote on a new bill, as Morrissey suggests, lawmakers must petition the governor themselves. While it's difficult to find all of the cases in which lawmakers have called their own sessions, the documents studied for this story indicated only two: a special session called in the 1860s under Governor Arthur Borman, and in the 1980s under Governor Jay Rockefeller. As research into the constitutional powers continues at the legislature, the question arises, are we seeing an increased concentration on the balance of power because of a narrowing gap between the parties? Armstead says it's possible.
So I think that's one thing that I'd like to see the legislature come back into its role a little more. And that's not a criticism necessarily of the legislature, but it's a criticism of what has happened, I think, over the last few decades, where we've become so deferential to the governor that we've never...
However, former Governor Bob Wise, who served terms in the state Senate and U.S. House before his tenure as governor, says it's not political, it's structural.
My observation is that there is a natural tension between the governor, the legislature, and the Supreme Court. And even when one party might have a great clear dominance in the Senate and the House, you still had different factions within that party that were always pressing to either limit the governor's power or to somehow alter the balance of power. So this is, to me, not necessarily partisan. It's just a natural tension that exists between the legislative branches. This is a natural process regardless of what party's in control.
A natural tension between two branches that often appear to be at odds. It remains to be seen, however, if a battle over abortions will sway the current balance of power. On Monday, our series on the constitutional powers of state government shifts from the tension between lawmakers and the executive to the third branch of government, the judiciary. We'll speak with two current justices on how they view their role in the battle of the statehouse and how politics affects their seats on the state's highest court. You're listening to Morning Edition on West Virginia Public Radio. It's 7:40. partly cloudy today with highs in the 60s and 70s, overnight lows in the 30s and 40s. Your forecast remains the same throughout the weekend, partly sunny Saturday and Sunday with highs in the 60s and 70s, overnight lows in the 40s. A Marshall University English professor has been named the 2013 Professor of the Year for West Virginia. Clark Davis has the story on a professor whose teaching style is unlike any other.
Katrina Schrey is an English professor in the Marshall University College of Liberal Arts. She's been named the 2013 Professor of the Year by the Faculty Merit Foundation. Each year, the Faculty Merit Foundation honors an outstanding faculty member at a West Virginia college or university. Schrey says her students were supportive and happy for her after her award. She says she's just not sure she's deserving because she still has a ways to go.
But I also know that the minute I stop trying to be a better teacher is the minute I should stop walking into the classroom. Every single day, after every single class, I go back and I go over it in my head. I replay scenarios in my head. I think, okay, so that went well, but this could have gone better. I think about contingency plans. And so I'm getting better, but I want to keep getting better.
Schrey has been at Marshall since 1996. She's already been awarded Marshall's top two teaching awards, the Hedrick Outstanding Faculty Award in 2013 and the Reynolds Outstanding Teaching Award in 2009. Schrey says students are different nowadays. She says her parents' generation learned by listening and her generation learned by seeing. And today's generation is much more interactive.
They're listening to music, watching TV, and they're physically interacting with their Wiis or their Xboxes or whatever the current thing is. I do think that interaction is a large part of learning. I think they're so much more socially oriented towards learning. I know that the jury's still out on a lot of these things, but I do know that when I walk into class and I offer my students a variety of experiences, the response is great.
Schrey says the most important thing she remembers each day when she walks into the classroom is simple.
That learning is inherently joyful, that people love learning. That's what we do as a species. We love learning. And I never want to lose sight of that in the classroom, not for a second, that learning is just joyful.
She also conducts writing workshops in Cabell County Elementary Schools. The relationships that Schrey develops with her students mean so much more to her than just writing a reference letter for them when they're looking for the next job.
And I see them grow up and I look at them and I think, wow, look at you, you know. And then I hear some of the good things they're doing and I run into them in the store, I run into them. There is absolutely nothing more satisfying for a teacher than seeing students just grow up.
Schrey received a Bachelor of Arts in both German and English from LaSalle University, a Master of Arts in British Literature from Georgetown University, and a PhD in English from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Clark Davis in Huntington.
John Gorka performs Give Us Back Our Water on this Mountain Stage Song of the Week.
Sorry about the water, heard it on the news. It's a scary story, rock you to your shoes. I don't know what I would do if I were in your place. Anger, helplessness, tightening my face. Give me back my water, don't mess with my air. Heard our children, I'm coming over there. Again, we're at the mercy of things we can't control. If they made me king, I'd say their heads are gonna roll. Roll them in the river, watch them bob and have a drink. Feed them through a cage, bread and water from the sink. Give us back our water, don't mess with our air. If you hurt our children, we're coming over there. Give us back our water, don't mess with our air. If you hurt our children, children were coming over there. Me, I can go back home. I live way out of town. Think I'll dig my well a little deeper in the ground. But no well is deep enough if enough don't care. It's the same water, it's the same air. Give us back our water, don't mess with our air. If you hurt our children, I'm coming over there. Give us back our water, don't mess with our air. If you hurt our children, I'm coming over there. Give us back our water, don't mess with our air. If you hurt our children, we're coming over there. Dear sons and daughters, we'll do what we must. Who do you love? Who do you trust?
John Gorka with Give Us Back Our Water. You can hear this and more music on Mountain Stage Sunday afternoon at 2 on West Virginia Public Radio. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can listen to and read news stories on our website at wvpublic.org. Support for West Virginia Public Broadcasting's news bureaus comes from Shepherd University, West Virginia University, Marshall University, and Concord University. Our producer is Ben Aduccio. Our news director is Beth Voorhees. Our director is Teresa Wills. I'm Ashton Mara.